You're listening to DVD Talk Radio.
So what did you bring to David? I mean, you're talking to all these other people, and they said that there was always a little bit of something that they brought to their character that was already drawn. But what did you bring?
Oh, that... I think I brought an honesty, I think, to the character that... I think it's kind of indigenous to a lot of local people here. It's sort of almost naivete that there's a sense of ignorance is bliss kind of attitude. It's not necessarily stereotypically surfer sort of character, but it's a carefree philosophy that I think David uses in his relationship and how he becomes attached to Lilo and Nani in the first movie. I haven't seen Lilo and Stitch 2, so I don't know what's... I only know sort of my relationship with Pleakley and these things that I've done in the studio, so I'm not really sure where it's going to go. But I think that I if there's anything, I would say maybe a native... a sense of a local dialect, a feeling, an impression of the pidgin language, sort of the sing-song, sort of the rhythmic mm-hmm. quality of the speech. That's what I think. That's why they kind of brought me on, because I grew up here and I have this, you know, kind of thing naturally. So.
Did you feel that for yourself it was important to ensure that this film carried that, or Lilo and Stitch carried that? The local feeling and the culture that it was important to stay true to them?
I think they wanted a touch of it here and there, and I think with the music that they chose for the first one, and I think with Tia coming on and myself coming on, we gave it a nice flavor to where it was authentic enough, but not to the point where it was unintelligible and not understandable. Because a lot of times if you do something too far pidgin English in the local dialect, if you go into some neighborhoods, it's very hard for the general ear to pick up. Mm-hmm. So it was a nice mix and a nice happy medium to where we could get a feeling of sort of this gentle, relaxed quality come through in the characters.
Jason, when you were a kid that grew up in Hawaii, how did it ever occur to you to become an actor?
I often wonder that a lot of times myself. I think, you know, it starts... I didn't know anything about acting, per se, but as far as being an athlete and a surfer and all these things in my childhood, surfing was always, even now, it's like a performance, you know. Everybody's looking to see who's going to take off on the biggest set, and who's that guy taking off on the biggest set, and what does he do with the wave, what does he do with his ride, you know. And then you get, you know, you get all this adrenaline, this rush from, you know, being able to perform on a wave in the moment. And so those are things that happen naturally, I think, as a person growing up here. And then when you do athletics, you're always performing for a crowd in some way. I mean, you are out there with an audience and stuff. And so when, I think it was... when I was in Los Angeles, I was going to school at Fullerton Junior College in Orange County. And I just applied and I thought, wow, there's an elective. I have a couple elective courses. I'll try an acting class. It's like, it seemed frightening. It seemed interesting. It seemed like, you know... and then because when I watched movies, I thought, oh my God, these guys like have all the freedom to just bounce off the walls. And I said, that's pretty cool, and that's a pretty good freedom to have. So I thought, well, let's risk it and just see what happens. So I started taking acting classes as an elective. And I never finished school or anything. I ended up being a part of an equity waiver theater company called the Friends and Artists Theater Ensemble, just outside of the fringe of Hollywood and Silver Lake. Mm-hmm. And we had a little black box theater there that was a 50-seat house that I started becoming involved with and became a member of. And gutted out this camera shop and turned it into a theater. So that was kind of the where I was at. And I didn't know nothing about movies, really. It was just the part, you know, just being a part of the theater. And we did some really powerful plays in that little space. We did a lot of absurdist plays. We did straight plays. We did a lot of some classical things. And but kind of across the board, it was there that it tempered me into like wanting to explore more of different cultural aspects of theater. And then I started doing movies, and the movies was just that as well. But the only thing about movies, it allowed you to travel to those actual places, you know, all over the world. And most of my project, I would say 90% of the films I've been involved in have been out of the country. So I've had this fortunate kind of life where I'm always working in, you know, Europe or Asia or somewhere in between. But most of the projects I've had I guess 18 years has been out of the country.
Is that what you like best about it? What do you like
about it? I love, well, initially I thought to myself when I was a part of the theater group, I thought, well, if I was going to do projects or films, it would be great if I could work internationally. Mm-hmm. Because when I was starting out as an Asian actor in Hollywood at the time, it was like, John Lone, I think, was the only actor around that I saw. And so I thought, well, I'll go to France, because France, they're open, you know.
Right.
And I could probably do theater there, and it'd probably be better for me for films. And then I thought, well, then I got Map of the Human Heart when I was 25, so I thought, wow, this is where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
A multi-international cast, working in, you know, northern Canada and then in Europe, and I said, this is it. This is what I've asked for. And so I've always had this feeling of wanting to work internationally, because I always felt the acceptance of being ethnic would be more appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, you know, through the years, you see how things come and go, and you get on some fast track sometimes, and you get some good roles, and then you get on a slow track, and then you just start picking up jobs. And so it's kind of a switch, but acting is sort of, I think, will always be with me. And the skills that you develop as an actor over the time, I feel you can apply to other, you can diversify that attitude as well.
Like
how?
Like, how do you apply the diversify? I don't understand.
Well, when I first started acting, I always felt like, I told myself, well, what do you want out of this? I said, well, I want to be the highest caliber of an actor I could be. But to every person, that's different. And every artist, that's different. And so some people might think the highest caliber of acting was to get an Academy Award, or to get an Emmy, or to have that kind of outward success. I was looking on a different way. I was looking on, you know, sort of the, it's sort of like how, if you have a sculptor looking at a piece of stone, what is he seeing? What is he seeing being chipped away to reveal that embodiment of what he's trying to see? So for me, I felt it was diversity. And through acting, everyone said simplicity, or do less. Well, less is more, something. So you get into the psychology of like, okay, what is less and more? Well, to be less and have more means your character has to be filled out. Your inside, your development, your cultivation of yourself has to be like, you got to be living. Yeah? And so a lot of these countries I went to, I'd see people without education, without theater knowledge, without acting knowledge, without material possessions, but incredibly dynamic individuals. Like, wow, how do you get that and put that on the stage or screen?
Mm-hmm.
What's making them tick? What's making them being so dynamic without nothing?
Mm-hmm.
And what I related it to was nature. They lived out, when I did Rapa Nui on Easter Island, they lived out in fishing every day.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived out farming and and riding horseback and just tearing it up, and that was that broadness, you know, that energy that they were emanating. So that gave me an idea. And so when I started studying martial arts and the Jeet Kune Do, the thing I learned from my teacher, who was a student of Bruce Lee, was that dynamics, was being able to go from stillness and go pow, just boom, you come alive. So how it affected your acting was like, okay, between stillness and maximizing your full potential and unleashing your consciousness to go through that psychic door, boom, all the emotions in between we're going to be able to access, be accessed. And there's no fumbling around, or let me get prepared, you know, build up my emotion. Forget it. You're in a nature, you're in a situation, you act now. Boom, forget it. There's no editing, there's no nothing. Mm-hmm. So that took me to a whole other place when I studied, you know, martial arts. So what that's done in my life is that I started looking for deeper and deeper sensitivity and awareness, two of the main things that you have to accomplish as an artist. And when you look at it, I looked at it as an artist, I went, okay, well, I don't want to be just specialized. I don't want to just be considered an actor. Well, not considered an actor, but to have acting skills is a great, great joy. But I wanted to see how it worked together. So I started farming. So I farm and I fish now. And I don't have an agent, I don't have a manager. And these things just kind of fall away. So now, looking at as an artist, I can say, okay, I'm coming from a really solid place. I'm fortifying, I have sustainable agriculture. I live off the grid, I can sustain myself, boom. Okay, that's coming from a different perspective. Do I really need the jobs? No, I don't really need, I can sustain myself. I can accept or not accept. The power I have is in my character. Then you realize what less is more is. And you realize what that's about. The simplicity of your living is gives you the strength of character and a really true understanding of what it is to live the art of life, I think. And that's the beauty of where these events and incidents have taken me. It's a path. Become a path.
How much surfing do you do or have you done?
When I was young, I surfed all the time. I mean, we used to steal. I mean, surfing to me was everything from just catching a wave, right? Body surfing or board surfing or boogie boarding. We used to, because we didn't have money growing up, we'd catch the bus, the city bus from Pearl City where we live, out to the North Shore. Stop off at McDonald's in the morning for breakfast. Pick up a brown plastic tray. I'd have maybe one fin that I find, you know, you find floating in the ocean. So you go down to the beach and you use the McDonald's tray as a boogie board thing. You
know? Oh my God.
And all day. So you spend all day in the water and then you got a little bit of change to buy lunch at the lunch wagon, you know, buying, they call monopole trucks or whatever. And you eat for an hour and you go back in the water. You're in the water 8 to 10 hours. And you catch the bus back home and you eat at home. Your parents got some food ready. You're like, down. And that was my life for, you know, all through my elementary school up to high school. And so surfing, if I'm in the water now, I'm fishing usually for mahi-mahi, ahi, ono or something, you know. But if I'm in the water, I want to come back with something. Because I already feel, surfing gives you a good feeling. It gives you a very centered, very nice, calm feeling.
What about the performance aspect of it that you were talking about? Is it the same kind
surfing,
of adrenaline rush that you get before you perform as an actor?
It's like any art. You can take it to your pinnacle. And right now, the pinnacle is big wave riding. Mm-hmm. And tow-in surfing. So that
what
is...
What kind of surfing?
They call it tow-in surfing.
Tow-in?
Yeah, they have these jet skis, and they have these special boards, and you hang on to this, like a ski handle. That you're being towed in into these monster waves. And you have to be very prepared. You have to know the ocean. You really have to know a lot of the how a certain wave will break and the conditions that you're in. There's a lot of investigation and research that goes into that type of surfing before you jump in and be stupid about it. But The guys that go are usually very, they usually think things out and lay it out, safety procedures, I mean, the whole bit. That's an aspect to sort of trying to reach the pinnacle of surfing, because there's no greater rush than coming down a monster wave.
Yeah. Jason, do you live here full-time?
I live on the Big Island full-time.
On the Big Island?
Yeah, the island of Hawaii. Uh-huh.
And do you come to L.A. at all, or...?
I think the last time I was here was to record this, Lilo and Stitch 2. They'll fly me in and then I'll fly out.
Is that a part of your future? Do you sort of maybe want to relocate there at some point, or are you really...
L.A.?
Yeah.
I lived there for 8 years, actually.
You did?
Yeah. I started the theater company, and not by myself, but I was a part of a theater company for about 3 years. I moved there when I was 19. I stayed there till I was 26, and right after I did the film Dragon, I realized that I wanted my lifestyle, because I didn't, L.A. living was not the lifestyle I was comfortable with, because there was nothing for me to do, I didn't feel, you know, so I wanted to come back here to fulfill what you feel comfortable doing, and breathing fresh air, of course. So I moved back when I was 26, and I've been here ever since. A lot of people told me that at the time, 12 years ago, they said, well, you're going to ruin your career. And they said, well, you know, people are going to forget you in Hollywood. I said, well, you know, that's a chance I take, and that's my, what we say in Hawaii, my kuleana, that's my business. I'll take care of it when it happens, if it happens, whatever. But I've been working, you know, once a year at least, pretty steadily, you know, for the last years that I've been here. So it doesn't seem to be a problem. I'm not a very big ambitious person in the world outside, in that I have to be on top of the show all the time. It's kind of like when you start living, in essence, for not for yourself, but for the future generations, it changes your concept of living, and it changes your concept of time. And in that way, by growing your own food and fishing for your own fish and living sort of a somewhat symbiotic relationship, it's a different approach. And nothing else seems to matter. I mean, you don't need so much to know that what knowledge I have that I can pass on to my children will affect them the rest of their life and will allow them to sustain, you know, in a very healthy atmosphere.
How many children do you have?
I don't have children right now, but I have responsibilities to children because of my position in Hawaii. I'm one of the, I think, few people who have sort of done success outside of the island in the movie realm, I think. And so for that matter, it's not a responsibility that I think I really have. It's just something that I want to give. And I know...
As a role model?
Not as a role model, just as how we... In order to sustain our ecology in these islands, we have to go back to growing our own food. There really is, it's a revolution of sorts, but it's not a revolution of war or of fighting. It's a revolution of culture, to retain and sustain your culture. All Hawaii culture, and the culture that is here, the spirit of the people, is based in agriculture. It's meaning that we all had a commonality to the land. We all had a common agreement that if you take care of what you have, then everything would be all right. Keikiokaini kapono, meaning it was a model that we, a philosophy that the Hawaiians had. Children of the land live in righteousness. And that means that if you take care of it, meaning when you came down here and you drove in, you saw the pineapple fields. That's not Hawaiian. That's American businessmen coming in and making money off of our good climate. And they're putting pesticides and herbicides and, you know, 150 years of chemical fertilizer into that ground. What will it take for our generations to reverse that effect so that they can grow good corn or taro or crops? It's thousands and thousands of acres of deforested land. Without forest, we don't have rain. People think rain, you know, sunshine is great. Yeah, it is great, but, you know, for people who don't have fresh, clean running water, and with all the development we have and the material population that's being produced, we don't have enough water to supply everyone's washing machines and dishwashers and flushing toilets. And I mean, you're putting a clean artesian water down the toilet. I mean, it's just, if we're looking at it as a Hawaiian and learning from my elders and teachers to look at the land and to be able to sustain yourself, we're headed in a very, very disastrous place.
Is this a movement happening in Hawaii?
Well, people are trying to resurrect the culture, but I think what's happening is that the culture is not, we're talking about it too much, and we're not doing it. Mm-hmm. And with a lot of people have been so far removed from the earth, the dirt, the mud, and that they don't want, it's like an allergy to them. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation. There's this complacency because of being spoiled that we've come to, and those are the places that we, you know, as a group of people, and whoever immigrates into these islands should understand that the westernization of Hawaii was not voluntarily accepted, you know, and there's a lot of documentary that shows that the exploitation. So to not try to hold a grudge or not try to blame anyone is to just take responsibility. And I think, you know, coming back home and being able to travel and seeing indigenous cultures that are suffering because of the same situation we're under. Same situation, all indigenous cultures, exploitation, business, and all that, and looking at it going, okay, how do you reduce the suffering of economic woes and having my aunts having to work 2-3 jobs when they're 60 years old to pay off, you know, whatever insurance they need to pay off. So those are issues that are close to me that I realize, like, how do you go about it without blaming anyone or having bad feelings or anything? And then just, okay, just start working it. Start doing it and see what happens. Propagate food. Grow under the canopy of the forest so that you don't have to take down trees. Plant more koa trees and, you know, do that. Educate the children to propagate that attitude and that righteousness for that land. That's the only thing we have. We don't have anything else.
What do you grow?
I grow taro and sweet potato and squashes and pumpkins and daikon radish and bok choy. And I mean, anything you like to eat. I just grow anything what I like to eat. And then fishing, you know, I can fish one day out of the week and I can supply my whole week with fish.
Really?
I can eat sashimi.
How do you fish? Do you fish in a boat or?
I have a boat and we fish, like, diving, spearfishing.
Yeah. Spearfishing and also pole fishing?
Yeah, like fishing from the boat. I have a small dinghy because I wanted to keep everything simple. So I have a little 15 horsepower motor with a little 14 foot aluminum. And we go and we catch ahi and big fish. And
do you think as you do that you'll stop doing films altogether, or do you think you'll continue to do film?
It's borderline. I'm not, you know, it depends on the project, because like I said, I don't have a manager, I don't have an agent, so it's not something that, you know, is holds that much precedence anymore. Because also when you see different parts of the world, you see that, you go, oh my god, we're spending $100 million on a film.
So why did you do Lilo and Stitch?
For Hawaii. I mean, because, I mean, it's, the change can't, if the change happens too rapidly, there will be total unrest within a culture. Lilo and Stitch is a gentle way, a superficial way of entertaining and accommodating people. It's not the reality of the traditions. of what is upheld. Ohana is based on family, past and present and future, the link between that. If you look at Ohana, it's like taking care of the land. If you don't take care of the land in the past, you don't take care of it in the present, it won't be any there for the future. And what will the other children have? They'll have a lifestyle or they'll have an attitude that is just based on materialism.
So and what about Lilo and Stitch is teaching these values?
Her care for Stitch, that no one is left behind, is still an attitude that you know, from watching the first movie, is the attitude that has to be, I think, instilled. Because we're all becoming so independent, we're all becoming so divided, and families are being divided. But the reason families in Hawaii are being divided is because we've moved far away from nature. We've moved far from the core of our existence, like most indigenous cultures. We don't have anything to fall back on. We fall back on our academic knowledge, which doesn't hold our existence, our sustenance. Those are things. Philosophy is okay, and philosophy in Lilo and Stitch has importance, but philosophy without action is nothing. So the real activity behind the movie, or something that I'm talking about right now, is going back to that. So unless you live it, you don't feel it. You don't understand what the connection is. I knew in order to talk about it, I can't bullshit. If I'm going to bullshit, my consciousness would bother me. I'm not going to do that. I've never been that way, even as a child. So if I can sit here and talk to you about environmentalism, about echo, you know, this and echo that, I better be living the life that I say. And that's something, being a figure that children look up to. If they ask me, you know, about things, I can talk to them about things that are of their culture.
So when you say Lilo and Stitch is a gentle way of doing what?
Of conveying the philosophy of the Hawaiian culture.
Do you have any new film projects coming up?
I did a film 2 years ago. It was called Nomad. It was done in Central Asia, in Kazakhstan. It was funded by the Kazakhstan government. It was one of the it's part of the history, telling the story of a young warrior who becomes the leader of the three warring nations, brings together the three warring tribes of Kazakhstan to fortify their borders against the Russians and the Chinese. And I guess Kazakhstan's coming into their own as a republic, and they wanted to show their culture and their history. And they brought me in as a character in the story. And I believe Miramax just picked it up to give it a wide release. So I saw it maybe 3 weeks ago in Kazakhstan, in Kazakh language and with Russian subtitles. But I imagine they're going to, you know, do it in English and bring it to the States and distribute it.
So what language did you speak?
I spoke English in it, but a lot of times we had a lot of Kazakh actors, so I would be speaking English and they'd respond to me in Kazakh and I'd respond in English. And you're kind of like trying to figure out what, you know, when you come in. It's like, what's my cue line? What's the last, like, sound that you make? So it was it was difficult, but I had a 5-month stay in Kazakhstan. And I guess Miramax found some value in it, so they took it on. I guess they picked it up at Cannes Film Festival, and then I guess they liked the fact too that Milos Forman was a executive producer on the project, so I guess he holds some reputation.
You've been listening to DVD Talk Radio. Find DVD Talk Radio online at dvdtalkradio.com.